I have two questions for you. Two questions. You don't need to answer them. At least not to me. Not out loud. Two questions for you. What problems are you dealing with in your life? What are the big problems that you're dealing with? There's one question. Question number two. What are you thankful for in your life? What are the things that you're most thankful for? You can think about that for a second. Okay, I have a third question for you. Which of those two questions was easier to answer? Is it easier to come up with the things, the challenges that you're facing? Which one could you discuss at length? Which one would be easier to sit down and talk to someone about and say, well, here's this and this and this and this? Would it be the list of challenges? Would it be the list of blessings? I think humanly, our tendency is toward the negative things. We have a little joke that you'll regularly hear people banter around at work, and even our boss has told us. He says, "You guys are only happy when you're complaining." We joke about it, but it does seem to be true that if there's not something to complain about, humanly, we're good at finding something to complain about. Well, there's this problem here. There's this thing here. Now, yeah, all this is going fine. But what about this and this and this and this? We should fix that. This is wrong. This is dumb. This is whatever it is. And we find reasons to complain. We're very good at complaining, I think. I am. I hope I'm not alone. We're pretty good at this, right? We're pretty good at finding the things, at finding the problems, and complaining about it. And humanly, we have this as our history. We have a history of complaining. Biblically, we have a history of complaining. And I want to look a little bit at that today. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 10. In verse 11. This scripture is one that is used regularly to sort of reference the Old Testament and say, this is, all those things happened for an example. And it's true. All of the things that happened to Israel generally, they happened as an example for us. And that's what Paul tells us here. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. He knew that it was the end of the age. And he's saying, this is, you know, we're now here in this final age of mankind. There are ways that you can divide up human history, you know, pre-flood, and then post-flood, and then post-Christ. And he's saying, look, we're here in this last bit, this end stage. And the things that were written before, those things happened as examples to us for our admonition, for our teaching, for us to learn about. But he had specifically called out some things in the verses preceding. Let's go to verse 5. He's talking about ancient Israel specifically, and he says, with most of them, God was not well pleased, and their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and did not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 fell. Verses 9 and 10 highlight the two examples that I'd like us to look at today. Because these speak more to the issue that I'd like to look at, which is really our tendency to grumble, our tendency to complain. We have challenges in necessarily finding and identifying the good things in our lives as readily and as easily as we can the negative things. And ancient Israel had this same problem, as we will see. So he cites two examples, and I'd like to go back and look at those two things historically as they were called out. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 9, he says, "Nor let us tempt Christ," or in the New American Standard Bible, it says, "Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents." He's referring to an incident back in Numbers 21. Let's turn over there. Numbers 21. Let's start in verse 1. Because he said that the children of Israel here, they tried the Lord. They tested him. And we'll see that they tested him through this tendency to complain. Numbers 21 and verse 1. "The king of Arad, the Canaanite who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to Atharim. Then he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. So Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, 'If you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities.' And the Lord listened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. So the name of that place was called Hormah." So Israel here has this big victory, right? They had some captives taken. They prayed to God. God granted them a big victory against these people. It was a big win. It was encouraging. It was exciting for them. And they happened to be in a place, they were just a little bit south of the promised land. Now let's see what happens next. "Then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea." Okay, Mount Hor is near modern-day Petra. I don't know where that is. I had to look on a map. But it turns out that Mount Hor is a little bit south of where the promised land would be. And this happened to be about somewhere toward the very tail end of their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Right, so this isn't Israel, oh, they've just gotten out into the wilderness and you know, now they know they're going to be here 40 years. This is right at the tail end of it. And so they've just had this big victory, right, just south a little ways of the promised land. And they're, if you're at Mount Hor, you would go pretty much dead north, and you'd be right there sort of into Israel. That's not what they did. They went south. Moses took them south. And we'll see why. They were going around the land of Edom, it says in verse 4. "And the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way." Now, if you're at Mount Hor and you're heading south toward the Red Sea, it's a very strange route. When you look at it, they were heading straight south along the west side of Edom, which was this sort of long little fingerlet type country. They were heading south on the west side of it. They were going to go down around underneath and come up on the east side of it. It was a very, very long way around this country. And it turns out that the east side of that country is not a place that you really want to be. It's kind of barren. It's pretty terrible. The satellite imagery of it today makes it look pretty awful. Not the kind of place that you want to be stuck. I don't know what it looked like a few thousand years ago. But it refers to it even then as wilderness. So this was not a pretty place. The reason they were going around Edom is because God had commanded them a long time prior, said, don't tempt those people, don't test those people, don't provoke them to war. The Edomites were descendants of Esau, and Israel being Jacob. This is sort of their brother country in some sense. And so God had commanded Israel, don't provoke the Edomites to war. And Moses took this very seriously. And so he asked the Edomites, can we just cut through? They said no. He said, we'll pay for everything on the way. We'll pay for the water we use. We'll pay for everything. We don't want to be a problem. They said no. And so here they are. They realize they could just have this straight little shortcut across the country. And instead, they have to make this big, long, circuitous route through some pretty hostile territory. And in the wrong direction, going the opposite direction of where you would think that they would want to go. So that's the setup. That's what's happening here. And it says in verse 4, the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. It's probably a little bit of an understatement. So they're out in the middle of the wilderness. It's pretty hot, pretty barren. They're running low on water. And in verse 5, the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. There are a few things wrong with their attitude here. There are a few little problems. They spoke against God and against Moses. Now, this isn't just, well, they're sort of bringing a complaint against him. They're bringing an accusation against him. They are coming against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? They've been out here for 40 years. God sustained them through some pretty amazing things, right? They had heard the stories from the previous generation about leaving Egypt. Remember, this is the next generation. This is the generation where God had said, you know, all of those who are here, who are complaining at me, who don't want to enter the promised land, you're all going to die in the wilderness. And they wander for 40 years. This is the next generation of Israelites. They've heard the stories about leaving the promised land, and then they've lived through some pretty amazing things. They've witnessed some pretty amazing things. But still, they have the same complaints that their parents did. They make the same complaints. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? This couldn't have just been a spur-of-the-moment thing. It sort of indicates, it looks like to me anyway, that this was probably a common theme. That this was something that, it wasn't they had just said this, 40 years ago, why'd you bring us out here to die? This was probably sort of a common little grumbling, murmuring thing. Moses brought us out here to die in the wilderness. And so this generation continues that, and they bring this challenge against God and against Moses. Why'd you bring us out here to die? They have absolutely no faith in God's purpose and in what he's doing. They have no faith in his timing. Because it says they became discouraged. They became, the word there also means impatient. They became impatient. And they start complaining. There is no food and no water, they said. There's nothing in the territory there that they can just harvest. But they did have food because, you see, they complain about it. Our soul loathes this worthless bread. They're talking about the manna that God provides them daily. Now, granted, they've been eating manna for 40 years. It's been their staple for 40 years. They've been eating the same food for 40 years. But they have manna. God's been giving them manna. This miracle that happens every day, 6 days a week, and a double portion on Friday. For 40 years, they have this, and they experience this. And here they are, this is possibly the worst part of it. Here they are contending with Moses and saying, this amazing miracle, this blessing that God has been giving us and providing for us for 40 years, we loathe this stuff. We hate this. And that's why you see the reaction in verse 6. So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people. Venomous serpents. It implies serpents that had a bite that was just painstaking to endure and then ultimately killed you. And they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. If you just read through this story and you sort of look on the surface, God looks pretty harsh here. Well, they just came and they're complaining because they're in hard circumstances, and then he kills them with snakes. But when you understand that manna is a type of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ points this out later. It was an act of God's graciousness. And they hated it. They detested it. They rejected it. They loathed it. And they complained about it. Very often we have this same kind of reaction. We're in some sort of life circumstance where we have something from God. At the very least, even when we're scraping through in some very tough circumstances, we have this calling, and we're here every week, and we have support from each other. We have something that's pretty amazing. And we have the ability to go talk to God, and we have the ability to be forgiven by God. We have something that's really phenomenal, something that's really incredible. And sometimes we go and tell God, we complain about whatever it is that we're dealing with. We say, why are you doing this to me? And it's really back on us then to be able to look at what we have been given, the amazing miracles and blessings that we have been given, and thank God for those things, rather than to do what we do, which I'm not accusing anybody of this. I just know that I do this. We have this tendency to complain about the circumstances in our lives that we don't like. And often, as it was in this case, comes down to some sort of timing problem. We grow impatient. We don't like the circumstance that God has kept us in for however long he's kept us in that. And so we decide to complain about it. So that's sort of our first lesson, that really we need to learn to be patient with God. Have faith and trust in him. He had carried them through almost 40 years in this barren wilderness and kept them all alive. And says he did other amazing things, like their shoes didn't wear out. You know, he did all these amazing things for them to keep them alive, to keep them going, to show them that, you know, no, I'm not bringing you out here to let you die. He was bringing them out here to care for them. We need to have trust in God, faith in God, that he is doing that for us also. He has a plan for us. He's got a purpose for us, and he's getting us there. We sometimes lose a little bit of patience with him, but we just need to hang in there and watch where he takes it. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 10. In verse 10, here Paul cites another example for us. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 10. He says, don't let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Notice Paul is being very inclusive here also. He's not saying, don't you tempt Christ. He's saying, don't let us do this. He recognizes the tendency. This is something that he wasn't claiming he was immune from. Let's not do this, he's saying, us. Nor complain, he says in verse 10. Let's not complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. He calls out complaining specifically, the testing of Jesus Christ that they did there, that he's referring to in verse 9. They came and brought that complaint, and they challenged him in that way by loathing those blessings that he had given them. Here he's calling out the complaint specifically. And they were destroyed by the destroyer. It's also rendered in some of your translations, probably it says, nor grumble. The word is that sort of thing. Oh, they'll grumble. This thing, I just don't like this thing. And so they came and they did this. Now there are a couple of incidents that this could be referring to. So we'll take the opportunity to look at both of them. Now let's go back to Numbers 14. Numbers 14 and verse 1. Now this, let's, from the point there with the fiery snakes, let's go back 40 years or so. And we're at Numbers 14. They're sitting right on the border of the Promised Land. God has brought them right up to the border. They said, why don't we send out some spies and let's go see how it looks. Let's scope it out, see what we're up against. And the spies come back and 10 of them bring this horrible report. And we pick up the story here in verse 1 of chapter 14. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, And the people wept that night. This isn't David praying and his pillow is wet with his tears, kind of weeping and lifting up his voice to God. This is just whining. What are we going to do? This is so bad. Because it tells us in verse 2, all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, whine, 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 whine. If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword? They're whining. They're complaining, right? And they're frustrated and they're angry and they don't understand and they're upset. But the main thing going on here is that they're complaining. They're not coming to God and saying, help me with my faith. Help me to understand. They're just coming and complaining to him. And we'll see that it turns ugly. If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. They whined and they grumbled. And we know that God punished them and said, fine, you're going to be here in the wilderness for 40 years. And the next generation will go on through and you will all die in the wilderness. Because they complained, because they lacked faith, because they saw obstacles, and they just didn't trust that God could help them overcome these obstacles. I want you to take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 1, because Moses talks to them about this incident. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 26. Moses is recounting the history to Israel. He's re-giving it. And in chapter 1, verse 26, he says, nevertheless, you would not go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. He had commanded them to go into the land, to take it. And they rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And you complained in your tents and said, because the Lord hates us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Where can we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying, the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. Moreover, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there. Then I said to you, do not be terrified or afraid of them. And he tells them why. They're seeing obstacles, and sometimes we hit these points in our lives where we see obstacles, we see problems, we see things that we just don't know how we're going to get past or we're going to get through. And he reminds them of their history. The Lord your God, who goes before you, he will fight for you according to all he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. This was the generation that had seen that. They'd seen the plagues. They had seen the Red Sea. And in the wilderness, where you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son. How does a man carry his son? You sort of pick him up by one arm and drag him along behind you. You know, if you're carrying a child, you're carrying him with care. You're protecting him. You're taking him through. He's going to see some things, right? If you're going through some dangerous situation, he's going to see some stuff that's probably going to scare him. But you're holding him. You're keeping him safe. You're making sure he's going to get through. And he says, in the wilderness, he carried you as a man carries his son. In all the way that you went until you came to this place. Yet for all that, you did not believe the Lord your God. They didn't have faith. They saw the obstacles and they didn't have faith that he was going to do what he said he was going to do. Who went in the way before you to search out a place for you to pitch your tents, to show you the way you should go in the fire by night and in the cloud by day. He had set up all of these things to be able to be a source of confidence for them. There's this pillar of cloud and this pillar of fire, and There's all this stuff to show that he's there, that he's present, that he's leading them, that he's taking them somewhere. And even so, they just didn't quite trust it. We have these same kinds of things in our lives. We have these same kinds of challenges, but we have this same presence. God's there, right? He demonstrates to us that he's there. We see it. We practice his way and we see things work that shouldn't work. We see his influence in other people's lives. We hear stories. We're here to encourage each other. We see these things. So when we butt up against some of these obstacles, we need to remember. We need to remember what he's done for his people all through history, all through the past, and even as we heard during announcements today, what he's done for his people in the Philippines, the protection that he affords, the things that he gives. We need to not just see the obstacles, but see that God is there with us, in us, getting us to a place, right? It says that he was searching out a place for them to pitch their tents. He was looking for a place for them. He had an ideal place that he wanted to put them. He's got the same for you and me. He has a purpose for us. And so he's trying to get us there, to get us to that. Now there's another place where it says that they grumbled that I want to take a look at. Let's go over to Numbers 16. Numbers 16 and verse 1. Here we see the issue is not, it's not impatience as it was when they were in the wilderness. It wasn't obstacles. That wasn't the problem here. There's a different problem here that causes them to grumble and to complain. Numbers 16 and verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, they took men, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. That's a lot of people. This wasn't just a few guys. I think sometimes if you hear about Korah's rebellion, if you're like me, you think about the old Charlton Heston movie, and you think, you know, he's bantering back and forth with Korah and Dathan or whoever however they depict it in the movie. And you think it's a couple of guys bantering. There's 250 other guys, men of renown, it said, leaders. And they're coming to bring a charge. Verse 3, they gathered against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" Let's drop down to verse 13. Again, they're addressing Moses and Aaron. "Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you should keep acting like a prince over us?" It says in the New King James, I believe, or the NASB, actually, it says, Is it not enough that you've brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but you would also lord it over us?" So again, there's a few problems with this complaint. There's a few issues here embedded in verse 13. Note they say, "Is it not enough that you have brought us up?" They're failing to recognize God's authority. And authority is really at the center of what's going on here. But they're failing to recognize God's authority. They're telling Moses that he brought them up. "Is it not enough that you brought us up?" And then they show contempt for the promised land. They say, "You brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey." That's referring to Egypt. They're talking about Egypt. They're saying, "Look, you, Moses, you brought us out of this great and wonderful place." And they describe it in terms that God uses for the promised land. So they're showing a little bit of contempt for what God has called them to. He says, "You know, you've brought us up, why? To die in the wilderness." Again, lacking faith in God and in his promises, and doing all that he did to get them out of there, they didn't recognize it. And then at the end of it, they say, but you would also lord it over us. Saying, isn't it enough for you to done all that, and now you're trying to lord all of this over us? They're showing contempt for Moses' authority. Ultimately, they're showing contempt for God's authority. And that was their chief complaint here. We do the same thing. We have a tendency to complain when we feel underutilized. That's probably a big one. There have been many, many times people complain, people leave the church because they don't feel they were utilized enough. This is an authority problem. This is a problem of somebody saying, I should have more authority. I should have more responsibility. I should have more recognition is what I want. Power is what I want. This is what I want. And so then when you get that sense, when you get that sense of I should be more, I should have more, I should be trusted more, I should do more. Why don't they consider me for this? Why don't I get to serve on this committee? Why don't I get to do this thing? Why don't I get to do this thing? I'm capable. This is exactly what Korah did. Why don't I get to do these things? And those feelings turn into complaints. We start complaining about whatever it is. Well, I want to be in charge of setting out the coffee. The person that sets out the coffee, well, they do a terrible job. And Mrs. Knutson just frowned at me. She does a great job. But whatever it is, whatever the thing is, we say, well, I want to do more. It's not just a church. It's wherever it is in our lives. It's at work. Well, I want to be the boss. So naturally, my boss is terrible. He's bad. And here's why he's bad. And let me go tell people about why he's bad. Because he shouldn't be in that position. I should be in that position. We can do this at home. Not respecting each other for the roles that we play in the family. And saying, well, I could do a way better job than my wife does at planning activities, which is completely false. But I could do a way better job of that. So I should do that. You do a terrible job at this. And here's why. And I'm going to take this. It's an authority problem. There are things about authority and power that at some point in everybody's life is appealing. There's something about position and responsibility that we want. And we want to be able to step into that. And sometimes it's genuine service that people step into. And notice a lot of the times the people that end up serving in some role aren't serving in that role because they're vying and jockeying for it. They're serving in that role because they just started doing it. They just asked if they could help, and they're there, and they're doing it. Generally, the folks that are complaining because they aren't serving in some capacity are wanting to be recognized so that they can be put into that capacity. So that somebody will say, you are so great, let me put you in this. Right? We shouldn't need that. We shouldn't need that kind of recognition. We shouldn't need to have this power play for authority the way that Korah did. Ultimately, those just little sort of feelings of not being utilized, which Korah and the others had, they felt they should be a part of the priesthood, they turned into complaints. Complaints don't stagnate, though. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. If you drop down to verse 41, what's amazing about all this is that God opens up the ground and actually swallows up Korah and Dathan and Abiram and their families. And it says it swallowed them up and covered them over. God did a new thing, is what Moses called it. And swallows them up. And then fire, it says, fire came out of the tabernacle and consumed the 250 men that were bringing a profane fire before God. That's all pretty amazing. I think what's even more astounding is what happened the next day. Verse 41. On the next day, all the congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." Now, that's attributing a whole lot of power to Moses, to think that he was the one that was able to open the ground up, that he was the one that consumed 250 men with fire. I'm not quite sure how they made that leap. And especially after seeing all that the previous day, you would think there'd be quite a bit of fear. But, again, just going back to human nature, they didn't like what had happened. And so they came and they complained against Moses and Aaron. And it says, "You have killed," and it's a very accusatory, "You have done this," is the way that the language implies. "You have killed the people of the Lord." Now it happened when the congregation had gathered against Moses and against Aaron that they turned toward the tabernacle of meeting, and suddenly the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. This was a big deal. This was something different. This wasn't just an everyday thing, oh, the cloud's there. Because it says the glory of the Lord appeared. That was something different. And Moses knew immediately that there was a problem. Moses and Aaron came before the tabernacle of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces. God had told Moses in previous times that, "I'm going to consume this people. I'm going to eliminate all of them and start over with you." And he'd said, no, please don't do that. People will blaspheme your name. And so God relented. So this wasn't the first time Moses had heard it. And he probably knew God was really serious about this. Verse 46, Moses said to Aaron, "Take a censer and put fire in it from the altar. Put incense on it and take it quickly to the congregation to make atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun." Then Aaron took it as Moses commanded. And Aaron here is at the very, he's an old man. He's not at the tail end of his life, but he's an old man at this point. He's in his 80s, let's say, 70s or 80s. It says he ran. He ran into the midst of the assembly. And already the plague had begun among the people. So he put in the incense and made atonement for the people, and he stood between the living and the dead. And so the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the Korah incident the day before. 14,700 people died because they complained, because they came and they didn't like the authority structure that God had set up. They didn't like what it was at that time. And again, it's changed many times through history how the authority structure is set up. That's not what we're talking about today. What we're talking about today is our reaction to it, is our reaction to authority that God gives. Because we read in the New Testament that all authority is from God. Not just church authority, secular authority. All authority that we have over us is from God, is what we read. And so we are to learn to respect it. And here we see that they rejected it. And God made it, it's interesting, because God made it very clear. You would think that he had made it very clear the day before who he had accepted and who he had rejected. But he killed those who came and brought this challenge against him. The next day, it wasn't simply taking those people out of the way. It was showing that it was Aaron whom he had chosen. Right? You remember, they had brought this challenge before Moses and Aaron and said, "You take too much upon yourselves. All the people are holy. All the people are the priesthood." And God is showing that, no, Aaron is the one standing in between the living and the dead. He's the one that God respected. He's the one that brought the proper fire. It wasn't a profane fire. It wasn't an unknown censer. Took a censer from the temple that was before God, and he took fire that was from the altar that was before God. And he went and he stood in between the people. And God made it very clear where he had had given authority at that point. And so it was a lesson for those who had brought that complaint. And they had simply failed to recognize it. So we've looked at three things here. And there are many, many, many things that we complain about. Sometimes we complain because we're impatient. Sometimes we complain because of we're discouraged at the challenges. Sometimes we complain because we feel like we should be more, have more, or do more, whatever it is. There are lots of other reasons that we complain. But these are the reasons that sort of jump out from the examples that Paul calls out in 1 Corinthians 10. Let's jump over to Philippians 2, because there's sort of a follow-up to this. Philippians 2, and verse 14. In a different letter, Paul is encouraging people along these same lines. Philippians 2 and verse 14. He says, "Do all things without complaining and disputing." When we think of what Korah did, right? It was a complaint and it was a dispute. Complaints don't stagnate. Complaints don't just stay as complaints. Oh, I wish that such and such would happen, or I wish that so and so would do something different. There's an underlying discontent when we have a complaint. There's this discontentment that we have and we do something about it. A complaint turns into something. Sometimes it turns into what it says here, disputing. It turns into arguing. It turns into contention between me and whoever it is I have a complaint against. Sometimes it turns into slander. You can imagine Korah, before he was able to get 250 guys to come follow him, he had to sort of spread this around. Hey, you know, that Moses guy, he's taking too much on himself. When the people of Israel are complaining about their lack of food and water and this loathsome bread that God had provided them, they're out there slandering Moses, slandering God. What is this? What has he done? He's bringing us out here to die. Right? Complaints turn into something harmful. They aren't just simply a statement about a problem. They turn into something bigger. Grumbling is harmful. It can turn into my complaint about someone else can turn in very quickly, can turn into something that will tarnish somebody else's reputation. Can bring somebody down. I can be sitting across a table from somebody at work in a private meeting and say, well, yeah, I just wish so-and-so wasn't, you know, this way about whatever it is. And now that person has an idea about that person's reputation, about what kind of person that is. And I've just tarnished that person's reputation unnecessarily. Complaint easily also, if you and I happen to be talking about something, we share a complaint, very quickly turns into slander about whatever it is, whoever it is that we're complaining about. They're harmful. And then they turn into disputes. We complain again, Korah coming to Moses, and they dispute about things. And they provoke blame. They'll provoke other people to blame you for something. They'll provoke you to blame other people for things. They stir that up in us. We have different challenges, men and women, I think, in these areas. For men, I think that this is a personal observation, but complaining is probably about as unmanly a thing as we could possibly do. And I think if you ask any woman that, she'll probably agree. There's nothing manly. I'm not saying this is a womanly quality to complain. I'm saying it's an unmanly quality to complain. If you want to go tell your wife, I don't like my car, my commute's too long. There's nothing manly about that, right? And yet, we have challenges that we face and problems that we face, and we like to fix things. And so sometimes when we're trying to fix things, rather than getting in and saying, well, here's a problem that I'd like to fix. Can you help me address it? Or here's a problem. I think I have a solution for that. What do you think? rather than doing that to fix things, we go, I don't like this. And somebody says, well, don't tell me about it. You go figure it out. Stop complaining at me. Right? Men, as we like to fix stuff, as we like to improve things, as we like to make things work, I think it's important for us to be able to again, identify problems, ask for help with problems if we need those problems, state what we're going to do about a problem. God issues a lot of complaints in the Old Testament, but he doesn't whine. He's not whining about people. He's telling, usually his prophets, he's saying, here are the complaints that I have against Israel, here's what I'm going to do about it. To Moses, he said, here are the complaints I have against these people, here's what I'm going to do about it. And then Moses contended with him and said, please don't. Right? This is a manly way to approach a problem. But it's never going to, you're never going to win over the ladies, you're never going to win over your wife by saying, I don't like this. It's not going to work. Women have different challenges. In 1 Timothy 3, talking about women who were going to be deaconesses, it says, women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. Again, you get to malicious gossip, you know, you back that up a few stages, and you're usually starting with a complaint. Usually starting with, I don't like this about such and such, or so and so, or this situation. Right? And it's very easy, again, when we're sharing conversations, it's very easy for those things to turn into, for conversations to just turn into complaining, which then turn into, again, other things. So if we want to be blameless, what he's saying here in Philippians 2, if you want to be blameless, don't dispute, don't make accusations. If you want to be harmless, if you want to be innocent, don't complain. He's telling us just do all things without complaining, without disputing. You'll be harmless. You'll be innocent. Children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. How do we battle this tendency that we have to grumble, to complain? I'd like to read some excerpts from you here as we close. I'd like to read an excerpt from a document. The year that is drawing toward its close has been filled with blessings of fruitful fields and healthful skies. To these bounties, which are so constantly enjoyed that we are prone to forget the source from which they come, others have been added, which are of so extraordinary a nature that they cannot fail to penetrate and soften the heart which is habitually insensible to the ever-watchful providence of Almighty God. In the midst of a civil war of unequaled magnitude and severity, peace has been preserved with all nations. Order has been maintained. The laws have been respected and obeyed. And harmony has prevailed everywhere, except in the theater of military conflict. Needful diversions of wealth and of strength from the fields of peaceful industry to the national defense have not arrested the plow, the shuttle, or the ship. The axe has enlarged the borders of our settlements, and the mines as well of iron and coal as of the precious metals have yielded even more abundantly than heretofore. No human counsel hath devised, nor hath any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gifts of the Most High God, who, while dealing with us in anger for our sins, hath nevertheless remembered mercy. It has seemed to me fit and proper that they should be solemnly, reverently, and gratefully acknowledged, as with one heart and one voice by the whole American people. I do therefore invite my fellow citizens in every part of the United States, and also those who are at sea and those who are sojourning in foreign lands, to set apart and observe the last Thursday of November next as a day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens. This was 150 years ago. This was written by our Secretary of State, Mr. William Henry Seward. It was signed by our president, Abraham Lincoln. This was the proclamation of Thanksgiving. It's why we keep Thanksgiving at the end of November every year. Because in the middle of a civil war, when everything was very difficult, 600,000 people died in this war. And they're in the middle of this war, and here they have the mind to stop and to say, we need to acknowledge God. We need to thank him for what he's done. It's interesting that we have to have a national holiday to remind us to be thankful. Because our tendency is to complain. Our tendency is to, again, to look at the problems, the challenges that we're facing, and to complain about those things. It's what we do. It's just part of what we battle against. And so we have a day to counter that, in a sense, as a national holiday, which is it's a nice thing. But we have commands even greater than that from God, that thankfulness needs to be a part of who we are. And this is what will help us battle that nature that we have to complain. Back to those couple of questions that I asked you early on. You know, what problems are you dealing with? And what blessings are you thankful for? We should be able to have those blessings in mind, have those things that we're thankful for in mind. Be able to focus on those. Yes, we still have to deal with the challenges. We have to face those problems. We have to figure them out and find solutions and sometimes endure them as long as they last. But we also must be thankful. We must acknowledge the gracious gifts that God has given us. The things that we take for granted, that we enjoy so much. And thankfulness needs to be really at the core of what we are. Let's close with 1 Thessalonians 5. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 15. See that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all people. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing. In everything, give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus.